Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for joining me. Tonight's show, it's all about New York's correctional system. We had a show like this just a few weeks ago when the statewide Wildcat New York prison guard strike had started. Now, after 22 days, the strike is over, and 2,000 corrections officers have lost their jobs. And what happens next? What about the striking corrections officers' concerns? What about the issues the State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision had before the strike even started? And what about the ongoing concerns of inmates and their families? Chris Gilardi reports on the state criminal legal system for New York Focus. I get his reaction to the end of the strike and his thoughts on what comes next, coming up in the second half of the program. Also, Chris has an in-depth article alleging nepotism and a system of patronage within the state corrections system that deeply involves current director Dan Marticello and his family. We'll be talking about all of that. But first, we start with Patricio Rabayo, who spoke with one of the corrections officers who are on the picket line at Woodburn Correctional.
Across New York State, nearly every prison fell silent, but not in the way that you might think. Cell doors still clank shut, inmates still fill the yards, but the officers who usually stood watch, thousands of them, were suddenly gone. In February 2025, New York's prison system was rocked by an unprecedented wildcat strike. Over 4,000 correction officers walked off the job without union approval and without warning. What has followed was a standoff that has lasted weeks, paralyzing the prison system, and has ended today with more than 2,000 officers fired. Governor Kathy Hochul has signaled that her administration is ready to move on from the strike, with efforts already underway to hire new correction officers to replace those who were terminated.
2,000 people who refused the multiple efforts we had to resolve this over a three-week period. It has been all-consuming. It has been wildly expensive for taxpayers, approaching $100 million. It created a very dangerous situation, which I called out from the second day. I said individuals walked off their jobs and left the incarcerated population alone, left other union members from PEF and CSEA who work in healthcare and in the food support area, left them alone. Thank God we were able to get this done. And there are consequences when people break the law. And that means you're not working in our state workforce ever.
Governor Hochul has signed an executive order prohibiting anyone who has participated in the wildcat strike from being hired into state service. She is also recommending that these individuals be removed from the Central Registry of Police and Peace Officers for cause, effectively barring them from future employment as police or peace officers in both state and local jurisdictions. David Cornish, who spent years working as a correction officer at Woodburn Correctional Facility, he is now retired, but he has been outspoken in his support of the striking officers. Cornish points to the skyrocketing violence in New York's prisons.
Nobody asked for any money. Nobody asked for anything else. They just want people to understand it has become hell on earth within facilities. Woodburn alone, just so you sometimes it's difficult to get the statistics right. So you'll see inmate on inmate assaults. An inmate on inmate assault does not count as a normal fight. An inmate on inmate assault is if there's a weapon used or a massive amount of injury, multiple inmates involved, just fighting. That's up in Woodburn over the past 3 years, 222%. Over the state, inmate assaults is up 147%. To give you the analogy, if we say we decided we were going to outlaw capital punishment and everybody agreed that's a fantastic idea, and in doing so, they slipped in that we're going to also allow murder, arson, rape, assault, and just about everything else. And when you say, hey, you've gone too far, you're told that, you know, you just want to have capital punishment. You just want to beat up inmates. This is the wildest conversation and just misinterpretation of what is going on. It's just sad. It truly is.
One of the biggest points of contention remains the HALT Solitary Confinement Act. Under the mediated agreement struck between state and the union, the solitary confinement is reinstated, but only to a limited extent. And correction officers said it wasn't enough.
There's a problem. It's mental health issues. It is hell on earth. It's where we created a hell in our country. And when these people came out and said, hey, we understand that we're in hell, but this is beyond what we can take. You have to pay attention to this. It's just become crazy. And you become the villain in the story. I don't know. It's incredibly sad. And, you know, you try to tell the media and it turns into us versus them and pick your side. And I don't know. I don't know what all the answers are, but I know there's a problem. And that's all they wanted people to understand is we have a problem. I mean, thousands. I'm going to tell you, most of these guys, 2,000 people, they're just like, they feel free. They've been fired and terminated from the job, and they are relieved that they don't have to go back. They're relieved. They're like, you know, fine. I can go on my life. That's giving you an idea how bad it must be. Six-figure salary. They've been terminated, and they're happy. They're frustrated, but they're like, there's a relief that comes off their shoulder. Like, I don't have to go back in there. I don't have to go back into that war zone again. I would tell new staff, this is not normal. This is the most bizarro, crazy world you'll ever be in. This is something else. And then to have all these hours and all these mandates and they're crushing these people, taking away all the discipline. And they walked out and said, I can't take it. Just safety. Somebody else. And what did they get? They want you. Do your job. What is this? Is this feudal Europe where you're a peasant and who are you? I mean, I think there's a lot of frustration. I'm a lifelong Democrat. My father was a union man, and I go to the Democrats. I'm like, hey, you know, what about these guys' rights, the workers' rights? And it's, you know, just no, you're not everybody else's rights, factory workers and. You know, anybody else, their rights are fine. But you guys, you're the bad guys in the story. We can't defend you.
Cornish says it's not just the physical toll that's driving officers out, but the emotional weight of what they're expected to endure.
What do you think is happening? What do you think has caused these officers to do this? They're losing their mind. People came back from Vietnam and there's stories of where they horrible stuff happened. You know, we look back and like, well, you know, they were in horrible situations. What do you think is happening? It's a cause and effect. You're in hell. You become it. You stare long enough into the abyss stares back. It becomes you. When I left corrections, I didn't understand how much pressure I was under. I had no idea.
But for many correction officers, the threats inside New York's prisons aren't always visible. They don't always come in the form of an inmate with a weapon or a fist. Sometimes it's in the air they breathe. At the Woodburn Correctional Facility, officers say they have been exposed to dangerous chemicals. Dozens have fallen ill. Some have passed out on the job, revived only by Narcan, the same opioid overdose treatment administered to inmates. This same chemical has also affected members of the National Guard who were deployed to the prison.
I believe it is one of the agents, the chemicals, from what I understand, is... It's the nerve agent and wasp spray. They called it wasping. They're creating these compounds using sort of these ways to get high from different things. And this agent seems to be a big one. Mm-hmm. And in the jail, it's called wasping. And you get it saturated like pieces of like this paper, or you crystallize it by boiling it down. Kind of make like a crystal meth kind of compound.
Yeah, I did a quick search while we were talking, and I found some information out of Weston, Maryland. It looks like people are crystallizing wasp spray and using it as a substitute for meth. And like you said, they're calling it wasping or sometimes wasp meth. apparently is cheaper than regular meth and has become more popular. And it seems like the effects are pretty serious. People who use it experience paranoia, aggression, and overdoses are common. And the thing is, this stuff does not show up on standard drug tests.
Yes, that's why they use it. That's why people, when they go and get blood work, when they go to the hospital, nothing shows up.
Yeah.
They're not looking for it. But one of my friends said he spoke to his comp doctor, who he was exposed. His hand still shakes from this. This was 2 weeks ago. And said that she believes that that's the compound that's causing the issues.
Wow. This issue has been brought to the attention of Assemblymember Paula Kay, who represents New York's 100th District. In a recent interview with Radio Catskill, Kay said her office is working with the Department of Corrections to temporarily halt incoming mail to state prisons. The goal, she says, is to identify how these chemicals or drugs are making their way inside. Radio Catskill reached out to Assemblymember Kay for an update, and as of this recording, no further information has been provided. Meanwhile, Governor Hochul has made her position clear. The state is moving on. Over 2,000 correction officers are gone. New recruits are being hired, and the National Guard troops remain deployed to keep the system running.
It's a high-pressure area. I get that. These are difficult working conditions. I understand that. I don't want someone working a 24-hour shift. It is not good for them or their families. But when we have people who, thousands who are out on workers' comp, 1,000 out on medical leave, which some legit, most legit, who knows, we'll investigate that as well. But also, I'm already down here, and now I'm down 2,000 more. The National Guard's going to have to stay a little bit longer, but right now it's voluntary as opposed to involuntary, which is important to me. It's over, but you walk out and violate the law, there are consequences.
But for people like David Cornish, they say it's not over, not by a long shot.
They're going to consolidate and more, and they're going to have these crowded facilities who are barely staffed with hardly any consequences. That is a recipe for a Attica situation. This is how you get these situations. You know, that's what comes in the end, is a complete failure of a system where people are killed. And it's a shame. Nobody listened.
And for those still inside New York's prisons, officers and inmates alike, the question now isn't just who's left to listen, it's who's left to act. In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dolp. We're covering the end of New York's prison guard strike and continuing to look at key issues within the state's Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, or DOCS, as it's called by its acronym. To do both of these things, earlier today I spoke with Chris Gilardi, who reports on the state's criminal legal system for New York Focus, and New York Focus is the independent newsroom, reporting on how power and politics in New York impact people's lives and how the state really works. Chris's latest article is New York's Prison System is in Crisis. We Investigated Its Ruling Family. This article uncovers the extensive patronage network entrenched in New York's Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. But we start off getting Chris Gilardi's response to the end of the strike.
Chris, my biggest take, I think, would to say that while corrections officers are returning to work, I hardly think the entire issue is over. Just hearing from both some retired corrections officers and people inside the prison system, tensions are pretty high as officers return back to work, as the National Guard starts taking a step back and things start returning to normal. Tensions are pretty high. There are also some unresolved issues. One of the main agreements that the department and the striking officers came to get everybody back to work is, one, pausing parts of the Halt Solitary Confinement Act. That's the solitary confinement reform law that went into effect in 2022, pausing parts of it for 90 days and then establishing a committee to review it. If listeners remember, this is one of the main issues that corrections officers had in walking off the job, is their dissatisfaction with these solitary confinement reforms. And it's to be seen what sort of agreements they come to or what recommendations they have for the legislature for changing the law over the next 3 months. That's the timeline that they set for reevaluating. So we're not out of the woods yet by any means, but it's good that, things seem calmer, if tense, in the prisons.
What will you be watching for in the immediate aftermath of the strike?
Well, I'll be keeping in touch with a lot of incarcerated people. I really want to hear how things are going inside the prisons as staff return to work. Just attitude, I guess, but also treatment. I think there's a big concern that corrections officers will come back and feel emboldened as they return to work. And yeah, I'll also be keeping close tabs on what actually happens with this quote-unquote review committee to review the HALT Act and what recommendations they actually put forth, and whether the legislature is actually open to amending the law. I think that's a big thing that hasn't been explored yet, because it's a law. It's not like the department can unilaterally make changes to these solitary confinement reforms. The governor is very limited in the power that her office has to change anything. So it'll take an act by the legislature if they want any substantive changes. And yeah, well, it's unclear to me so far how that body as a whole will take these recommendations.
And this brings us to the article that I want to talk about. You just put this out just a week ago, and the headline sets this up here. New York's prison system is in crisis. We investigated its ruling family. So this is basically, you're doing a deep dive on the background of Commissioner Daniel Marticello of Department of Correctional Services.
Yeah, that's correct. Pretty much it took about a year and a half of reporting, deep dive into what we call the Marticello dynasty. The current commissioner, Daniel Marticello III, he has been at the top of docs for a couple of years now. And he actually comes from a very, we call it the Marticello dynasty, a very influential prison agency family. His father was a superintendent at a maximum security prison, and he was also an administrator for that region of prisons, and was very influential in docs, according to a bunch of documents that we got through Freedom of Information Law requests and through some court records, as well as over a dozen former agency staffers that we spoke to just about the family. So his father was in docs for a long time. Four of Dan Marticello's five siblings work for the department. His brother, specifically Chris Marticello, is the head of the department's internal investigations unit. That's the unit that it's called OSI, the Office of Special Investigations. It's the unit that if there are complaints against a corrections officer or against an incarcerated person, they investigate and look into it and, recommend discipline and all that kind of stuff. So his brother came up through that, as did a lot of his family and friends. And today, so Daniel Marticello is the commissioner, two of his siblings, including Chris and his eldest sister, Catherine, are assistant commissioners. So there are Marticellos throughout the executive wing of DOCS. And he really came up through the system and is really a product of it.
That OSI and this so-called friends and family network, that aspect of the story, it seems like this is really about who knows who throughout, and using this one agency almost like a hub to coordinate who's getting certain jobs.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. One thing I've learned in talking to a lot of corrections officers, both for this story and over the years, is that the prison agency, and I think this is also the case with sheriff's offices and similar agencies, it's really a sort of who you know kind of business. And yeah, DOCS is no exception to that. So yeah, this office, the Office of Special Investigations, or OSI, it's a somewhat desired job. It doesn't involve working in a prison. It's Monday through Friday. It's fairly normal working hours. And this friends and family network, as it's been dubbed by staff, really has found a home in it. So a while ago, before Chris Marticello, Dan's brother, rose in OSI, one of its heads was a family friend of the Marticellos. He brought in Chris Monticello, the brother. He brought in a couple family friends, actually, and they found little pockets of influence within the Office of Special Investigations and really shot up the rank.
As I read through this article, and at a moment like that, I'm thinking, like, well, how exactly do you know? I know you're looking at, you know, documents that you got through Freedom of Information. But it was almost at that moment in the story that you say, well, here's an exact example of how somebody got pushed out and somebody else was put in there. And that was an example that was, you know, has so far held up in court. That person who was pushed out sued, correct?
Yes. And, you know, we're very lucky. I've heard more rumors and more allegations than I can ever report or corroborate about Doc's nepotism and this family. Luckily, we got a lot of like hard documents and corroboration from a variety of sources. And this, for certain anecdotes, in this case, was one of them. I think you're referring to the case of a guy named Al Monagheri.
Yes.
So in 2014, this guy, Al Monagheri, was named head of OSI's sex crimes unit. And, you know, former staff described him as a very like straight up, very anti-corrupt, good government type of guy. And he immediately got on Chris Monticello's bad side. Long story short, the primary documents we could get through court filings, Chris and some other OSI investigators launched this investigation that turns out to be pretty bogus. Still, they pursue this investigation into some alleged misconduct against Al Monagheri. It goes to a hearing, and a hearing officer finds him not guilty, finds the allegations pretty impossible to have happened. And still, Chris Monticello, who is then at that point a high up in OSI, and then Dan Monticello, the current commissioner, still, because Dan Monticello has power as a DOCS administrator, push this guy, Al Monagheri, out of his OSI title, send him back to prison work. Immediately after that, they install one of the family friends into that position. Al Monagheri sued. He eventually won a $500,000 settlement, though DOCS is appealing. But yeah, it's really, according to former staff, this is pretty typical, though luckily this one we have really good documentation to prove it.
Yet for all of this, you do paint a fairly complex picture of Daniel Monticello, again, director of DOCS in New York State, because he's both a reformer and he's also a product of this entrenched and fairly corrupt sounding system here. How do you as a reporter see those conflicting roles, and how do you think he balances those roles?
That's a great question. I'm really glad you asked. I think this is really important, actually. So Dan Monticello, now the head of the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, we outline it in many thousands of words, came up through this very shadowy system, is a product of sort of this patronage network himself, but also it is a sort of progressive. It's somewhat of a reformer. Progressive, I'll put that in quotes. He's as progressive as you can sort of imagine someone who's the head of a sprawling carceral system can be. But he's really won over some prisoners' rights advocates. He's won over some progressives in the state legislature. He's been described to me as very sincere, as someone who really cares about improving conditions in the prisons. He's put in place in just his first 2 years as DOCS commissioner, he's put in place some modest but not totally insignificant reforms, expanding like education programming and improving access to phone calls, things like that. It's really part of his ethos. He thinks that in order to make prisons safer, in order to make them safer for both incarcerated people and staff, you improve conditions within the prisons and give incarcerated people a sense of purpose, which I think really is congruent with what reformers across the state have been pushing for many years. And that's, that's pretty antithetical to, I think, the standard politics of of your standard prison boss. It has certainly made him unpopular it certainly made him more unpopular with corrections officers, especially now with the strike and with a lot of pushback against against prison reform being like at the center of the strike. So he's a complicated character. I think from my perspective, it does seem like he really cares about his job and he cares about the incarcerated population, even if he came up through this very shadowy system. And I think that just really points to how embedded these kind of like patronage networks are. Even if you have this complicated character, this kind of as progressive as you can get person at the top, he still came up through this pretty corrupt system. It's just sort of what you get when you have a big prison system.
You know, and I asked you about balancing those kind of two sides of his persona and approach and his reality, and you end the article with what you just touched on in that explanation is another balancing act. And here's your final paragraph is, quote, how Martucello balances the demands of the 14,000 guards who work for him and the welfare of the 33,000 people in his custody will determine the future of a system that's shown itself to be a powder keg. As his past becomes clearer, the future of the agency he leaves becomes more uncertain. So that's a clear indication that you've been doing this research for a year and a half, and it's come to fruition at this particular powder keg moment in New York State corrections. And you're saying, you know what we found here, that doesn't make the future look any brighter here under his leadership. But this brings us back to where we started, talking about the news post strike. So given everything that we've gone over and what you were saying there this powder keg moment, what do you think? Where are we now with Dan Martucello at the top of corrections?
You know, great question. I'll be interested to talk to corrections officers and former corrections officers as they go back to work and how they see administration. Like I said, I in the beginning of the interview, I don't think we are really anywhere near resolving the underlying tensions that kicked off the strike. Those underlying tensions are many. They don't only come from corrections officers either. We haven't even mentioned that a lot of the current turmoil started in December when we saw a video of officers beating an incarcerated man to death. Just a couple weekends ago, there were reports that just across the street from that facility, guards beat another incarcerated person to death. The corrections officers do not have a high opinion of the commissioner. They are very dissatisfied. Incarcerated people are also pretty dissatisfied, and there's a lot of tension between them. And you have this guy at the top who has sympathies for both and is you know, under fire and getting it sort of from all directions. So I think where we go from here really depends on how quickly they can turn down the temperature in the prisons. That's both by improving conditions and also by satisfying corrections officers' demands. And how well Dan Martucello can walk that tightrope, I think, is a big part of the answer to where we go from here with all the turmoil in the prison system.
Has there been any reaction to this reporting?
I have gotten quite a bit of response and feedback, both from family members of incarcerated people and current and former DOCS employees. The response I've gotten so far is that this is pretty widely known within the prison agency, you know, the underlying fact that there's this friends and family network, and that people are glad that it's out there in the open. And I should say, for anybody who has information and wants to offer more or who has perspective on the current DOCS administration, I'd always love to talk to more people.
And Chris Gilardi reports for New York Focus. This article is up now at nysfocus.com. We'll also be pointing it up on our website, wjffradio.org, along with the full version of this conversation, because we've only had time to put part of it on air tonight. Go to wjffradio.org for the rest of it. Chris, thank you so much for this reporting and for taking the time to break it all down for us like this.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great.
And that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole, been your host. I will not be in tomorrow, but we will still have the local edition here for you every evening at 6. And Tim Bruno is going to be here with you every weekday morning at 10 with Radio Chatskill. Don't miss either of those shows. And stay with us now for more news on The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.